Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there, Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
You know, the last few months have been extraordinarily troubling for many Americans, and there's been many issues that have been bothering people and have been the center of concern in national politics. One has been what some see as the resurgence, others as a continuation of white nationalist organizations and sentiment. Obviously, this flared most dramatically at Charlottesville this summer. And there's also been concern about how some of this rhetoric, some of these persons have even entered the inner circle of advisors surrounding the president. While some have stipulated that this is more of a new phenomenon or something that is outside the mainstream American traditions of our country, others have argued that in some ways this white nationalism is more a part of American life than we are willing to acknowledge. And today we have with us one of the great U.S. historians, Linda Gordon, of NYU, who has just written a new book, an important book, entitled The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and the American Political Tradition, published by Norton. Linda Gordon, with whom I co-edit a book series at Princeton University Press, is a pioneer on many issues, including the history of gender in U.S. history. Her early books focus on a number of important social and policy issues. She wrote The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction with Harvard University Press and a book about Dorothea Lange with Norton, both of which won the Bancroft Prize. She's one of only three historians to have won this twice, and she's also the author of a fantastic book, Sam, that I use in my class all the time, Pitied But Not Entitled, about social policy in the 1930s and how gender influenced the structure of programs like Social Security. But today we're here to discuss her new book, The Second Coming of the KKK. Linda, welcome to our show.
Thanks, and I appreciate your having me.
Let me start by just asking why you decided to tackle this question of the KKK in this decade at this point.
An important question, because the fact is that I am not or had not been any kind of expert on the right or conservatism. It happened that I was doing a larger book, which is still unfinished, about social movements in the 20th century U.S. And there was a chapter on the Klan, and there had to be a chapter on the Klan because it was far and away the biggest social movement of the 1920s. But then when Trump happened and Trumpism happened, my editor, my agent, many friends said, really, you should try to get this out now. So then I went to work and expanded a chapter into a book.
And you call it a social movement, which is part of the book in terms of how we should think of the KKK in terms of how it operated and mobilized. Can you tell us more about how it was a social movement?
Yes, I can. First of all, one of the common denominators of many social movements is, of course, simply mass participation. And there was no question about that in the case of the Ku Klux Klan. It liked to claim it had 5 million members. And even if that was an exaggeration, we are talking about something that's really quite massive. But, you know, I should mention something else about this whole issue of what counts as a social movement. I think many people assume that social movements are an alternative to electoral politics. The fact is that if you look closely at many social movements have worked in close connection with electoral politics. And that was the story par excellence of the Ku Klux Klan. It had tremendous electoral success, and much of that included came from the ability of its mass membership and very, very public pressure to intimidate politicians and to intimidate voters and win what they set out to win.
And you start the introduction with a story from a July 4th picnic in 1923 in Indiana, and you describe it as the Lollapalooza of a carnival. 50,000 people came, and you describe it reserve train cars brought in people from throughout Indiana and nearby states. This giant gathering made its participants feel part of something vast, patriotic, and noble, a celebration of Americanism. The food was so plentiful it required several rows of tables, each extending the distance of a block. In addition to the heaps of casseroles and desserts that women brought, the organizers provided 5,000 cases of pop and near beer, 50,000 buns, and 6 tons of beef, not to mention the 250 pounds of coffee and 2,500 pies. And you go on to talk about the performers, a boys singing quartet, a film that's being showed, and you even have an advertisement about the event with the headline, Big Barbecue, 20 Bass Brands, and then High Tight Wire Walking, 100 Feet in the Air, Wild Bronco Busting, and more. Why did you start
Sounds
the story?
Fun.
Right. So why did you start the story of this notorious organization with that picnic?
With that, because I thought it was very emblematic of a key factor about the 1920s Ku Klux Klan, and that is that it was not secret, and indeed for vast, vast numbers of people, it appeared like a totally respectable, legitimate organization. But at the same time, this kind of large-scale, you might call it a pageant, resembling something like a county fair but magnified many times, that was a very key recruiting technique for the Klan. These big events, usually held in the summer, were usually outdoors, and anyone at all could go. There was no limit of any kind. And it represented, on the one hand, the Klan's power. These events always concluded with the very dramatic burning of crosses, and some claim that some of the crosses were 50 feet high. But it was also a way of normalizing the Klan, of making it fit into something that was very traditionally American, such as a July 4th picnic. And I would say, thirdly, it also associated the Klan with patriotism, and that was a very, very powerful part of the Klan's appeal.
Now, if I think about the KKK and the kinds of things that they were advocating, white supremacy and so on, I think about it as something that is geographically, I would expect it to be in the South, and yet that seems not to be the case. So can you talk about the geography and also the origins? I mean, if I'm thinking back to that time, I think about a few years previous to the period that you're
Sure.
that you wrote about, D.W. Griffith, Woodrow Wilson. So how did this relate to the nation at large?
First of all, the first Ku Klux Klan, which was born in the South directly after the end of the Civil War, was much more circumscribed in its membership. It was allegedly secret. And that was part of the reason for the robes, although recent historiography suggests that most people in a community knew exactly who were members of the Klan. And this first Klan had really only one purpose, and that was to use violence, lynching in particular, to intimidate African Americans, and to see to it that the emancipation from slavery did not really emancipate them, but what really represented a different apparatus of white domination over black people. That Klan was always limited to the South, and it continued well into the period of the career of what we now call the Second Klan. The Second Klan was really the brainchild of a guy called William Simmons, who actually had a combination of motives. One is he wanted to build a larger fraternal order at a time in the United States when fraternal orders were very common and millions of people belonged to fraternal orders.
So what, Rotarians, Masons, and KKK?
Money. What?
Rotarians, Masons, and the KKK, like that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And and in fact, you know, there are a lot of similarities between many of the respectable fraternal orders and the KKK. For example, they were often ethnically and religiously segregated, right? You would have an organization of Italians, an organization of Poles, an organization of the Irish, etc. But he also wanted to make money. And this is a very important thing to understand about the Klan. It was essentially a for-profit corporation. It was registered as a corporation, and in fact, in a way that would probably seem very surprising to people today, when the first imperial wizard, William Simmons, passed the leadership on to the next imperial wizard, Hiram Evans, Evans had to actually purchase the Ku Klux Klan from Simmons. Today, many of us might think that there's some kind of a contradiction between an organization supposedly based on advancing certain principles and one out to make money, but there was no contradiction for the Klan, who, if anything, honored the profit motive and the rich and making money. Anyway, Simmons did something unusual, and to the best of my knowledge, it was the first time any social movement had done this. He hired a professional PR firm in Atlanta, which is where the second Klan originated. And this PR firm that really consisted of two people hit upon another strategy that was really what made the Klan. It seemed to them, apparently, that the Klan could not gain traction in the North if it focused exclusively on African Americans, partly because there were so few African Americans in the North at this time. And so they expanded their sort of bigoted hit list to attack Catholics and Jews. And that was the move that really made the Klan what it is.
So that was their national breakout?
Yes.
Huh. Now, wow. So if I think about social movements, you know, around that decade, maybe plus or minus a decade, I think about the right to vote for women. I think about the temperance movement. I think about the labor movement. Did these movements coexist geographically in a city or a town? Could you have different factions? Were they friends with each other?
Some yes, some no. The women's rights movement, well, the women's suffrage movement was over by then because in 1920, women gained the vote. And although there were many other women's rights issues, the movement became much smaller. In the previous century, the temperance movement was probably the largest social movement in the U.S. That had a tremendous overlap with the Klan. The Klan was a staunch supporter of prohibition. Many of the women in the Klan were members of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, a very large and powerful prohibitionist organization. The labor movement is much more complicated. This was not a period, the 1920s, of a very strong labor movement, though there was a national organization, the American Federation of Labor, and the Klan had a very complex and contradictory relationship to the labor movement. Most often, it opposed workers' organizations, and that was largely particularly true when those labor groups consisted of particularly immigrant workers who might have been unusually large numbers of Catholics or Orthodox or Jews. And so in those cases, the Klan bigotry kind of fused with an anti-labor perspective.
And one of the turning back to the money issue, one of the fascinating parts, I think, for many readers will be the way the Klan raised money selling stuff, merchandise. It's kind of incredible.
Like red baseball hats?
Well, from the costumes, which you never really think about where they got the costumes, to you talk about jewelry. you know, a gold-filled ring with the Klan emblem. These were ways for the local chapters to raise money for activities.
Logo wear.
Yeah.
Logo wear. Yes, a good name.
Yeah.
Well, it was always a real money-raising and a very successful money-raising operation. But some of those things were, products were monopolized by the national headquarters of the Klan. So, for example, the manufacture of the uniforms was done nationally. On the other hand, any local person who saw an opportunity to make some money could devise some little trinket with that associated itself with the Klan through an emblem or the letters or whatever, and make some money off it. And this goes along with another factor that's hugely important, and that is that the Klan was advertising in newspapers constantly and openly. It advertised not only these things for sale, but it also advertised lectures, inviting people to come and find out about the Klan and possibly join the Klan. It was completely different in that respect.
So from respectable. It was respectable.
Yes.
Harry Truman was a member of the Klan. Is that right?
Several politicians at that level were, although, like Harry Truman, many of them quit as soon as they thought to enter national-level politics because at the national level, in many parts of the country, that was still something a little bit risky.
So were there parts of the country where the KKK was still considered radical and shameful?
I suppose you might say, of course, that those parts would have included cities where there were a lot of recent immigrants who were not Protestant. And, of course, one thing to keep in mind is that in many ways the Klan's success owed to the fact that it mobilized a backlash against a very, very large immigration that had taken place starting in the 1880s, going on through the 1910s. And in that large-scale immigration, the vast majority of the immigrants were not Protestants. And there was a rhetoric about that immigration that is actually quite reminiscent of what we hear today, which is that these people were coming and trying to steal our jobs, trying to subvert American values, trying to subvert what the Klan considered the destiny of America to be a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. So in a city like New York, the Klan did not have massive support. On the other hand, there are some real anomalies there. In the city of Chicago, which had plenty of immigrants, was a very industrializing city by this time. The Klan was very large. If I remember my own figures correctly, it might have had 50,000 members in Chicago. So we have to understand that you have this kind of conflict just about everywhere in the United States, between people who were somewhat more tolerant and people who were really suspicious and fearful of the new immigration.
And one of the dynamics that's important, I think, reading this today, and very interesting, there were journalists trying to write exposés about the Klan. And you mentioned one, I remember, from the New York World. And the investigative reports were not intended to be supportive. But in the end, they actually increase recruitment?
Exactly. Well, you know, people who are in the media have like the adage, any publicity is good publicity. And so the condemnation of the Klan, of course, brought it to people's attention. But it's also true that the nature of the condemnations of the Klan actually exacerbated the Klan's fear and anger. We see this particularly in the way that many of the critics like to say that Klanspeople were just a bunch of uneducated, parochial, country hicks, people who didn't know any better, people who were unsophisticated. There were two things wrong with that. The first thing is that it isn't true. Now, in the last few decades, historians have found some membership lists of the Klan and have been able to check those membership lists against census data to find out who were members of the Klan. And you find there were plenty of educated people, of professional people, of managerial class people, of white-collar people. And it's also worth keeping in mind that the Klan was not cheap to belong to. There was an initiation fee of $10, and in today's value, that was worth well over $100. So this is not an organization of poor people. So anyway, this kind of disdainful talk about the Klan, and this is the second problem, is that it merely evoked even greater Klan hostilities to the people they saw as their enemy. And the people they saw as their enemy were secular, somewhat liberal, urban cosmopolitans who were more comfortable with a diversity of different backgrounds and cultures.
Luckily, there's nothing like that today.
Right. And of course, you know, very particularly the allegation about cosmopolitanism was really a code word for Jews and a pretty widely understood code word for Jews, that these were the people who, because of their international connections and so on, they could never be patriotic Americans.
So if people are talking, I don't know whether historians like to or don't like to do this kind of thing, but obviously this is on your mind. If we talk about resentment for liberal elites today, is that a code word for something? Because I think that when I hear people on the right talk about their resentments of liberal elites, I don't think they mean Jews. So like, what are these code words for today, do you think? Or maybe
well,
it is.
That's a very interesting question. I don't think there's a simple translation of that code word. But I do think that one thing that is very similar is that we see in the alt-right today a notion that that the enemy is big city liberals, secular people, but also this notion of cosmopolitanism, because of course the alt-right today does rest on the very, very strong notion that of American patriotism, American first, America first, just as the first Klan supported the isolationism that was pretty widespread in the 1920s. So today we see the alt-right resentment and refusal to participate in international accords of various times and wanting even to withdraw from international trade agreements.
I see. So when you write about mass Americanism pageants, you write about Americanism pageants, and so there are these
yes.
clonvocations with Americanism pageants.
Yes.
As a non-white person, I'm just guessing that they don't mean me. Is that these are code words for whiteness?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Huh.
The Klan believed, and the Klan put this in religious terms, that God intended the United States to be a country of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. This religious ideology extended to a frequent Klan little adage, which is, if Jesus was alive today, he would be a Klansman. And you can see many Klan cartoons that represented Jesus walking among people in Klan uniforms. So this kind of Americanism is a very exclusive one, and exclusive also in the sense that it is not accurate, because the United States was never a country exclusively composed of Anglo-Saxon white Protestants.
And so one other part of your history of the Klan, which is interesting, are divisions and tensions within this organization. And one chapter deals, it's titled KKK Feminism, which is probably not a term most people would think of, but you go through some of the ways in which this 1920s organization, social movement, you see some of the tensions we've studied in other spheres of American life over gender roles playing out within the Klan. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Sure. And just as a preface, let me point out that this was the chapter in which I expect to get the most pushback, because I think there are a lot of people, including many friends of mine, who would like to think of feminism as exclusively a progressive orientation. The fact is that what I think the Klan's women showed, and there were about 1.5 million of them, was that there is nothing inherently about seeking greater rights for women that is incompatible with bigotry. And I think, you know, we've had many, many discussions about the most recent presidential election, in which a lot of feminists were extremely disappointed, but even surprised that so many white women would vote for someone they perceived as bigoted. But there is a tension that arises there, and it seems to be a tension that arises very frequently in more conservative women's movements. And that is that while on the one hand, in what they said and what they wrote, Klansmen would probably articulate a very conservative gender ideology. They would say that women belong in the home, that women's primary service to the society was as mothers and as supporters of their husbands. The fact is that in practice, they started engaging in more public kind of politics, and once they started doing that and leaving their homes to do this kind of Klan work, they began to enjoy it. They felt it as fun, they felt it as empowering, and because of that, they actually started in some cases to resist the male leadership and the control that the male leadership commanded or tried to command over the women's organization, which it saw as just an auxiliary. One example, in some places, the male Klan leadership tried to choose the women who would head the local women's Klan chapters. In several cases, they actually wanted to put their wives into those positions. And in many cases, the local chapters fought back and insisted on choosing their own leaders. Some of the women's chapters began to resent having to send a great deal of their dues money upwards to the national male headquarters. In a very particularly visible act of defiance, they insisted on moving the headquarters of the Women's Ku Klux Klan away from Atlanta, which was the headquarters of the main Klan, to Little Rock, Arkansas, where they established an independent headquarters.
Can I ask you, just as a broader question, you are a historian who spent much of your career writing about movements and causes that are antithetical to the KKK, and you've supported all issues that contradict what they were about. How difficult is it as a historian to go back and to do a really deep dive to the point you're looking at selling, you know, trinkets and shirts and robes and jewelry? How difficult is it to take on that challenge, or is it not different than any of the other kinds of subjects you've studied?
Well, it was definitely a lot more uncomfortable for me. For example, I collected not only a lot of Klan speeches and written materials, but also a lot of the cartoons that they used. And some of them are so foul that I chose not to use them in the book, and I don't want to use them when I give talks about the Klan, because I simply don't want them to see the light of day. Secondly, I think that as an American Jew, I had not been accustomed to having to feel so saturated in the ugliest kinds of anti-Semitism. And I'm sure I would have had the exact same reaction to their anti-Catholicism. So it was not pleasant. On the other hand, you know, historians have methods about the way they do research. And in that sense, there wasn't anything wildly new about this. I think the thing that was most new for me in terms of method was that I was actually using a lot of local studies of the Klan that had been done by other people, because obviously there was no way I could do an in-depth, archivally based study of the National Klan. And so I feel very strongly that in doing this book, I'm, so to speak, standing on the shoulders of a dozen or more historians who have done really yeoman's work in digging up local materials on the Klan.
Now, to bring it back to the current day, you said that there's something like 4 to 6 million members of the Klan back then.
Three to five million, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And today, of course, there are only a few thousand members. But I want to talk a little bit about the size of the alt-right movement and differences between now and then. And this gets a little bit into other domains such as technology. So even if the alt-right movement is much smaller today, the means of communicating these sorts of ideas are much more efficient, whether it be Twitter, whether it be organized people like Mike Cernovich, whoever these purveyors are of extreme far-right ideas. It's far more efficient to get these ideas across, and you don't really need logo wear, and you don't need picnics with block-long food displays. It's still possible to corral hundreds of thousands of people, maybe, you know, millions of people, and to have their ideas propagate really quickly. Is there anything that we can learn either from how these ideas propagated or what technologies were used then and now? Because it just seems that it doesn't take very many people now to trigger that same feeling of solidarity that people felt then with their hoods and their trinkets and whatnot.
Yes, I think there are connections, but I'd also use a couple of caveats. One is that today, to the best of my knowledge, and I am not an expert, the alt-right consists of a bunch of really very decentralized smaller groups. There is no single national organization, and that is true even of the Ku Klux Klan today. And furthermore, today the Ku Klux Klan is but one of many of these racist and bigoted groups.
Do you think that by being smaller in number, it's harder for them to spread a message? Because I seem to... You know, these are groups that are far more in the public eye than they were a year ago. And so it seems that technology makes a difference here.
It does. And I would say there's both a good thing and a bad thing about their decentralization. It is true that despite the rapidity with which they can spread messages, being decentralized means that they do not have a coordinated national strategy. On the other hand, the fact that they are decentralized means that there is no discipline around them, and that there is no kind of controlling of what some of these small groups can do. The second Klan, which tried hard, I think, at the level of its leadership to remain nonviolent, it did have small groups engaged in vigilante actions, but by emphasizing a nonviolent strategy, a strategy of just discourse in electoral politics, they actually made a lot of gains. So I think there's good things and bad things about the decentralization. Obviously, there's absolutely no comparison to what goes on today in social media. But I would point out that the Klan was very technologically sophisticated. They used radio avidly, and radio was a relatively new technology at the time. There was the head of the Woman's Ku Klux Klan in the state of Indiana, which was one of the strongholds of the Klan. She established what she called the poison squad, and what she meant by that was a kind of the equivalent of a phone chain through which she could get messages to women throughout the state. And she claimed that within a matter of a day or two, she could get a message to every Klan's woman and Klan sympathizer in the state of Indiana.
Targeted ads.
Yes. The Klan may have had some hostility to science, particularly evolutionary theory, but they loved modern technology. One very literally vivid example is that after a while they stopped using oil-soaked rags to create burning crosses and substituted electric light bulbs because they lasted longer and you didn't have to maintain them as well. So obviously they didn't have what we have today, but they certainly exploited every possible new technological means of sending out their message.
All right. Well, we are out of time, but I want to thank Linda Gordon, a professor of history at NYU, who is the author of a very important and fascinating new book, The Second Coming of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s and the American Political Tradition, which has been published by Liverlight and is available everywhere. So thanks for joining our show.
And thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, that wraps up our episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.